this is definitely data that we need to start looking at. It's definitely needed to understand this, because we know, you know, that women experience some mental illnesses such as anxiety and depression and PTSD disproportionately to males.
Welcome to FemPower Health. This is Georgie. Today is the final episode of our enlightening three-part series on the evolving world of psychedelics in healthcare. In our previous episodes, we delved into the current legal landscape, safety protocols, and the vital role of education for clinicians, discussing policy, ethical practice, and cultural considerations in psychedelic-assisted therapy. Today, we're joined by Andrew Penn, a clinical professor at UC San Francisco, who shares his profound insights into the use of MDMA for treating PTSD and psilocybin for major depression. Andrew brings to light the complexities, challenges, and potential of psychedelics in mental health treatment. Join us for this riveting conclusion, where we bring together the critical aspects shaping the future of psychedelic therapy into our healthcare system. All right, Andrew, I'm so, honestly, in all seriousness, I'm so excited to connect with you. I know you're a very busy, in-demand person. I'm just really appreciative that Lynn Marie had introduced us. You came highly recommended by a bunch of sources. And honestly, I had decided to do an episode on psychedelics. And then I started talking to some folks and I realized there's no way that I could cover this with justice in one episode. And so it's turned into a three-part series. And honestly, it could probably be a 20-part series. But for the purposes of FemPower Health, I think three parts should be sufficient. And if, of course, there's more questions, we can do follow-up. So I really appreciate you making time. Why don't you tell us about yourself and how you got into this field and what you're doing within it? Because I do think it's so unique and interesting. So please share that with us.
Yeah, sure. My name is Andrew Penn, and I'm a clinical professor at UC San Francisco in the School of Nursing. I'm trained as a psychiatric nurse practitioner. About 20 years ago now. And I divide my time between teaching in the School of Nursing. I teach advanced practice nursing students, so people that are going to become psychiatric nurse practitioners. I work at the San Francisco VA doing clinical work and overseeing residents there. And I also spend part of my time doing research on psychedelics. So that's a very interesting and very robust area right now. Worked in the past on the MAPS-sponsored study of MDMA-assisted therapy for PTSD, and also on the USONA-sponsored study of psilocybin for major depression, a single dose of psilocybin for major depression. And more recently, I've been working on some small trials that we're doing in our lab looking at people with bipolar 2 disorder who have depression, treating them with a psilocybin intervention. Also recently completed a small trial of people with depression and Parkinson's disease. The two studies I just mentioned, the bipolar study and the Parkinson's study, are important. Even though they're small studies, those are two groups of people that have largely been excluded from trials to date. And so we want to see if we can begin to see if there's evidence for safety in those populations as well. And then we're getting rolling on a study of people with chronic low back pain, and are gearing up to do a study of young adults with anorexia nervosa, all of which we're addressing with a psilocybin assisted therapy intervention.
I mean, this is honestly just such a fascinating topic for me. I know that Michael Pollan has written about psychedelics, which I think has helped people, I guess, make it feel more mainstream, so to speak.
There's a lot of hope and a lot of hype around this space right now. And part of the challenge, especially for somebody who is new to it, is sort of separating the wheat from the chaff. But even for those of us who've been in it for a while, we're finding that, you know, many of the subjects who come into our lab have real big hopes for this, which I understand, because we don't have the treatments that we have right now for a lot of mental health conditions are not as effective as we would like. So I fully understand the need for better treatments. It's just, we're still in a very early stage of this. So there's a lot of things that we just don't yet know. And that's just the nature of science. That's okay. You know, that's why you do science, is to try and answer those questions. But in the absence of data to answer these questions, we're finding that a lot of people are engaging in kind of rampant speculation. And that's creating a lot of challenge and a lot of sort of noise in the space that's difficult right. to cut through sometimes.
When things are out there, especially now with social media, people pick up on it, and we're in this quick fix society where we're not really diving deep into things and we're making a lot of assumptions. And let's face it, I mean, I know when I was going through my 4 years of fertility treatments, you kind of get in the underground because you're trying to find an answer. And so, you know, in light of kind of that tone, what is it that you want people to know that we're not discussing, especially for those who are more on the open-minded, I'll try anything side, perhaps because of fear and desperation in trying to get help?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I certainly understand the motivations for being interested in this. You know, as I was mentioning a minute ago, the shortcomings of the current mental health system leave a lot of people either untreated or undertreated. You know, they're partially treated, and they you know, they might feel better but not well, and that's an important distinction. And I think where there's some challenges in the messaging around psychedelics, I think there was this early notion that this could be sort of a one and done treatment, that you know, you hear this phrase, oh, it was like 10 years of therapy in one day. And yes. I really think that's overpromised on a number of different levels. So the data that we're seeing right now as to the durability of the effects of the treatment, they vary. But you know, the reality is probably this is something, you know, if we look at something like psilocybin for major depression, the durability might be 6 months to a couple of years. And then the person would probably need to be retreated. And in the early studies that we saw of this, we were seeing people who, you know, would go several years out and still say they didn't feel depressed, which is great. And there will be people like that, but I'm not sure that's going to be the average response. So I think one sort of myth to unpack is this idea that this is one and done and curative. And you know, frankly, I was part of that hype at the beginning too, because in our very early studies, that's what we were starting to see. But the nature of doing clinical trials is that you are, you start with a very kind of cherry-picked group of subjects who are you know, likely to be able to, that you can treat them safely, and you know, that they're kind of ideal patients in some ways. And then as you get into larger studies, what we call phase three studies, there's it's more representative of what real patients look like. It's still not perfect, because there's a lot of things that we exclude people from that have complexities, like other medical conditions, other psychiatric conditions, comorbid substance abuse. That, so we exclude those people from phase three studies usually, but that's who represents our real world patients. And so there's always this challenge in sort of translation of, are you going to get the same benefits with the people in real life that you got in the clinical trials? And, you know, we've seen this time and time again in psychiatry. When SSRIs first came out in the 1980s, you know, people talked about curing depression, because in clinical trials, they were so robust. And then we bring them out into the real world and we give them to people who have, you know, medical issues, or they have an alcohol use disorder or what have you, and they don't work as well. I think not because they're not going to work, but I don't think they're going to work as well as they are sort of currently promised. And the way that they will work is going to be different than what we're used to. And I think this is an important thing to understand, is that a lot of our treatments that we use right now, say common antidepressants, they are effective for some people. You know, it's very fashionable in the psychedelic space to kind of make a straw man argument about SSRIs and talk about how, you know, there's not many of them and they don't work very well. And there's certainly some truth to that, but they do work very well for some people. And we're going to need both. We don't need to eliminate one with the other. What we need is more treatments, not fewer treatments in psychiatry. And so this will be another option, hopefully. But the way that they work, the way they affect this change, appears to be somewhat different in that things like SSRIs generally tend to kind of blunt negative emotions. And they sort of turn down the volume on anxiety or depression. The downside is they tend to turn down the volume on other emotional experiences as well. So people on SSRIs will say, well, you know, I don't feel as depressed, but I just don't feel as much of anything. You know, I used to cry in sad movies. Now I'm just finding myself not feeling it. And so there is this challenge with them is that they sort of dampen people's emotional experience, which if you're depressed is not necessarily a bad thing, but it's different than how psychedelics work. So psychedelics tend to be, you know, sometimes the term is non-specific amplifiers. And so they turn up whatever happens to be present right now for the person. And so they tend to take somebody's emotional experience. And when they're done in this, when they're used in this more therapeutic setting, they often are really that person will be confronted with whatever it is they're dealing with. And that often gives them an opportunity to work through that, to feel more confidence in feeling those feelings, because, you know, we spend a lot of time as human beings trying to avoid feeling what we are feeling. Something called experiential avoidance in the psychology literature. And psychedelics are really counter to that. So they really tend to amplify whatever emotional experience the person is having. And this is one of the reasons why good preparation is so important. So before, you know, just to be clear for people that have not heard of this work before, you know, sometimes people ask me, will I just go down to Walgreens and get LSD? No. So what we're looking at here is a model where this is really a psychotherapy model that is catalyzed, amplified, if you will, with the judicious use of a drug 1, 2, maybe 3 times. So instead of taking a drug every day, you're having this preparatory psychotherapy process with the therapist, sometimes 2 therapists. Those same 2 people are going to be in the room with you when you take the drug, and you have all day kind of carved out for that. So you got nothing else going on that day. And really during that dosing day, we encourage people to go inward. So the other misconception a lot of people have is that we're sitting there doing, you know, cognitive behavioral therapy for those whole 8 hours or something. No, most of the time when people are under the influence of the psychedelic, they're not really talking very much. And in fact, we encourage them to have this kind of inward experience. We provide eye shades, and we have a pre-selected set of music that people can listen to really direct their attention inward. The drug will wear off after 5, 6, 7 hours. And then starting the next day, we begin doing this thing called integration, where we talk about the experience that the person had, try and unpack that, look for opportunities possibly for them to change something about the way that they're engaging in their life, the way they're thinking about themselves or thinking about their circumstances. And we might repeat this process depending on the study protocol. In the MAP study, we did that 3 times. In the USONA study, we did it just once. So there are these different models of doing this, but it's just important to understand that sometimes that psychedelic experience, it's not all rainbows and unicorns. It often can be quite challenging. It can be quite beautiful, but it can also be dark. It can be scary. You know, in something like a PTSD study, we get the agreement of the subject. This is part of the preparation of, if your trauma doesn't come up during the session, can we bring it up? Because we're going to spend some time talking about that. And that's really, really important, because a lot of times people with PTSD spend an inordinate amount of energy trying not to think and feel about the traumatic experience. And so we want to make space for that in this therapy specifically. So those are some of the differences. The other thing that I think people need to understand is that while psychedelics are largely physiologically safe, you know, compared to say something like an opiate, which in large enough doses suppresses breathing and you can die from, psychedelics generally have a high margin of physiologic safety, but they can be psychologically challenging. And especially if they are used in settings where people don't have the support of somebody who knows what they're doing when that person is in that state, especially when somebody is taking this in a societal context in which these are against the law, where people can lose their job over this, for example. So that engenders a kind of fear around this, where people who are having a difficult experience might be apprehensive about seeking help for that, you know? And so this idea that these are without any potentially negative side effects, I think is untrue, and it's misleading people. I think about that recent case of the airline pilot who had ingested psilocybin a couple of days before, and then, you know, when he was on the plane, had this experience of what we call in psychiatry derealization, that things weren't real, and that was his rationale for pulling the fuel cutoff switches on the plane. You know, that was somebody who was clearly having a challenging psychiatric experience that was likely secondary to recent ingestion of psilocybin. Was he on psilocybin at the time? No, because psilocybin doesn't last that long. But he was experiencing some challenging effects following that. And I wonder, might that situation been different had that person had more support and a place where he could talk about those experiences before he had to go back to work? So I think the misconception I want to clear up is that, you know, while these are relatively safe physiologically, they do come with some potential attendant psychological challenges that can be mitigated with good support and a good structure to support that person in. And that's, so you can't necessarily replicate these things by finding somebody who grows mushrooms and taking this on your own. Now, you might, I mean, we haven't tested that. We haven't studied that to compare if the two are comparable. But you know, there's a lot of people who are kind of charging ahead of the science. The culture is charging ahead of the science. Laws are starting to charge ahead of the science. And, you know, as a scientist, that concerns me.
Like which laws that are charging ahead are most concerning to you?
Well, I see a lot of well-intentioned laws around decriminalization. So to be clear from the outset, I think drug prohibition is a totally failed public policy. The idea of putting people in prison for changing their consciousness is bad policy. It doesn't work. That said, sort of letting the floodgates open and letting the commercial sector come, you know, or even the sort of de facto commercial sector come in and offer, say, something very powerful like psilocybin widely without much guidance or without a culture that has an ability to absorb that. You know, we don't have good messaging around what is a safe setting to use psychedelics in, what is an appropriate dose, how long should you plan for. Those are all public health messages that we need to have out there to go along with something like decriminalization. And there's this kind of urgency to get this stuff out there, in part to correct the wrongs of the past, which I fully support and appreciate. You know, I do think that we as a culture can develop an adult relationship with this in much the same way we have with cannabis. So, you know, 25 years ago in the US, you know, cannabis was still this largely prohibited substance. You know, a lot of people went to jail for it. People still go to jail for it, you know, particularly people of color, particularly marginalized communities. It's often used as this kind of cudgel to harm people with legal repercussions. But I think in the last, you know, now I turn on my social media and I'm getting ads, you know, for cannabis, and not just CBD. You know, I'm seeing, you know, THC and Delta 9 and Delta 8 and Delta 10 THC being sold, you know, in social media ads. So, you know, clearly we've come to a different relationship with that. And I think we can do the same thing with psychedelics, but it's very early days still.
Okay. Interesting. So you mentioned that you're looking at bipolar 2. I have a particular interest in this because, and Lynn Marie and I were talking, I was like, should I say this? She's like, well, when you share, that's when you open the door for others to feel comfortable. So I will share. So I have bipolar 2 and, it sucks like really bad. I have to like monitor so many things. Like the biggest one is sleep. Like what time I go to bed, how much sleep I get. And sometimes I can't control it because I've hit menopause. And so it's just like all these layers. And, you know, I actually had done an episode on cannabis and someone sent some to me and I tried it. And I don't know if it was COVID, perimenopause, you know, having my son and no one around to help during COVID, or if it was the cannabis, I went nuts. And I was like, I am not touching this. It sat on my shelf and expired. And so I think about like this study. And so one, I'm like, how in the world do you do it? What is the risk? Like, can someone have a psychiatric break? Because I've been on all sides of the stream of mental health having this. And so I'm so curious about like the precautions, what you're seeing that you're allowed to share. Like, how would someone in these states where it's like, I would so want a solution, but I also see when it's bad, it's scary that I'm like, no way. So I'd love to hear about that.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. You know, for your listeners, it might be worth just briefly differentiating out these different bipolar numbers.
Please.
What do they mean?
Yep.
So, you know, when bipolar disorder is historically something called manic depression, and bipolar 1 disorder is where people have periods of depression and they also have periods of what we call full mania. So in full mania, somebody for many days at a time, you know, often sometimes several weeks at a time, will have periods of a very elevated energy. Sometimes it can have kind of a euphoric or grandiose quality. People get lots of ideas and they'll often be talking very fast. They might sleep, you know, an hour a day, maybe even not sleep at all. And after a while, it really starts to, people's judgment becomes impaired. They can become impulsive and it often ends with a really rough depression, which can go on much longer than the manic episode. So these manic episodes are usually kind of infrequent visitors, but people spend a lot of time being depressed. So that's bipolar one. Bipolar two, which you're talking about, Georgie, is where somebody, it's really a condition of chronic depression with kind of a cyclical quality. So the depression will come and kind of come and go. And we differentiate this from depression in which is sort of a response to outside events. So people with bipolar disorder often will have, they'll fall into a depression and they'll have no idea as to why. Because there is, it's not reacting to something in the outside world. It's more a reflection of their internal biology. And they spend a lot of time being depressed. And the reason it's not just called major depression, which is what most people think of when they think of depression, is because of these periods. So there's a cyclical pattern to it, but then there are these brief periods of what we call hypomania. And hypomania is where somebody for maybe a day or two has an increase of energy, you know, maybe a week, an increase of energy, but it's often not very pleasant. It often can feel kind of restless and agitated and anxious. Am I describing this accurately?
Yes.
Georgie? Okay.
Yes.
You know, you're not able to sleep, but you're exhausted, you know, it's kind of wired, but tired. It's not a good feeling at all. There's not a lot of enjoyment in those periods at all. And so the reason why we've been cautious in the trials to date around bipolar disorder is that there are case reports. I've written one, that's in the literature, myself, that of people getting either having mania or having psychosis type symptoms. So when I say psychosis, you know, feeling paranoid, feeling like maybe things aren't real, feeling like people are trying to harm you, those sort of distortions of reality, if you will, consensual reality. And there are reports of people with bipolar disorder having these episodes elicited by psilocybin and other psychedelics. And so when you start doing clinical trials, you're exceedingly cautious in who you allow into the trials in order to maximize safety. And then as you begin to develop some knowledge base around for whom this is safe and whom it's not safe, which is just as important as knowing for whom it is safe as knowing who can be harmed by it, a treatment is then you can start to kind of work on those edges, right? And so the reason why we chose bipolar 2 instead of bipolar 1 is that, you know, we want to make sure that we don't We don't make people worse, you know, is really the short answer. Ideally, we want to help people feel better. So in a pilot study, which is what we're doing, you don't have a placebo control. So we know what we're giving everyone. Everyone knows what they're getting. And we're looking more at the safety signal than the efficacy. We'll look at both, but really the first question to answer is, can we do this with a small number of people without making them worse? And we're very early in the study, so we haven't actually analyzed the data yet, but it'll be interesting to see if we can do this safely. So that's the question that we're working on right now. And if we can do it safely, then that creates the sort of foundation of evidence that we can then go on to do larger studies with more people, maybe with a placebo control to try and control for some of those expectancy effects that we talked about around Michael Pollan, and then really start to see if this can be something that helps. So, you know, these sort of insights help people understand, like, why does this take so long? This is why.
Yeah, no, it's true. And, you know, I hope you find something, because you're right. It's like, I even talked to my therapist. I'm like, today I'm like on it. And so this is the day where I am like tackling my list, because I don't know how long it's going to last. And I'm still very productive. Luckily I've never like sat down and like had to like crawl into bed for 3 days. I've never been like that, but I'll struggle to like do things the way I normally do. And I used to never be like this. And so it's incredibly irritating, because I literally have no idea. So I'm like, control sleep, control what I eat, and I hope for the best. Every day.
Yeah. No, it's, you know, and, you know, you're certainly not alone in that. And I think for people that struggle with that, or any really, you know, kind of chronic episodic illness, which affects your ability to function, part of the burden of that is that unpredictability. You know, what's tomorrow going to bring? I don't know. You know, will I be able to do these things that I plan tomorrow? I don't know. You know, we'll see what tomorrow brings, but it definitely is part of the challenge for sure.
Do you have either anecdotal or data, anecdotal evidence or data around menstrual cycle timing or even phase of life? Because, like, for example, when a woman is in perimenopause, within a given day, the hormones are all over the place, much less over a given menstrual cycle, however long that menstrual cycle chooses to be at that point in time. You know, and then obviously when there's all these added layers, like now a lot of women are undergoing fertility treatments, you're given additional hormones. So there's all these like hormone related activities that are happening. Like Lynn Marie even said, is there a certain time of the month where if someone right. is on a regular cycle, it's better to give it than not? So what do we know so far about that?
I think the short answer is not enough, not a lot, not enough. And some of that is, it's not willful neglect. I think it's just a artifact of the relatively small sizes of these studies so far. And that most of these studies are focused primarily on creating the evidence that would be necessary for getting this to the FDA and having FDA approval. Once you have that approval, it becomes a lot easier to do studies of different populations, right? And so, you know, if we were to look at something, so one of the larger studies that was done recently, there's been two what we call phase two studies of psilocybin for major depression. The one I worked on, I think we had 108 subjects, something like that. And the one that was done in the UK had a little over 200. So if we say, you know, roughly half that population is identified female at birth, you know, we've got 100 people or 50 people, and where, you know, that question of where they are hormonally at any given moment is another large variable. And so this is definitely data that we need to start looking at. You know, I think it's definitely needed to understand this, because we know, you know, that women, for example, experience some mental illnesses such as anxiety and depression and PTSD disproportionately to males. And so that's one big challenge and one area that we, you know, this is another underscoring why we need better treatments for this, for these conditions, is that that women suffer from them disproportionately, and we need better treatments. And we also know that biologically there are these closely tied relationships, say, between estrogen and mood, progesterone and mood. Serotonin and estrogen tend to kind of track each other. And so, you know, there are these fairly predictable mood experiences that people have, you know, in the premenstrual phase, for example, or postpartum. And so there's a huge need for this, for sure. And then understanding, I mean, there was, I do believe in the MDMA study phase 3 that female sex did predict a better outcome for people that were randomized to the MDMA group. I'm not sure what to make of that, but you know, that I think is encouraging news, especially given that the women are over twice as likely to experience PTSD in their lives. So, you know, and then there's a whole nother subset of understanding that we need to gather around transgender patients, you know, and how does hormone replacement therapy impact the effects of these, and are there, should we be thinking around timing? You know, I think your point is well taken that the effects of these may be attenuated by where somebody is in their menstrual cycle. There is Natalie Gukasian at Hopkins did an interesting case series of three women talking about changes in their menstrual cycle following psychedelics. And so, you know, there may very well be a signal there, but you know, we are really just in very early days with this. There's, you know, we need better funding to do the research so we can really begin to explore these questions on a large scale.
And I know it's harder, more expensive, and takes longer for women, but like, they're half of our population. And so
there are reasons to be hopeful around this.
Yes, of course.
You know, so psychedelic therapies could be included under a broader umbrella of what we might call rapidly acting antidepressants. And so this would also include things such as ketamine, but also, you know, a drug called zuranolone, which is an oral version of a drug called brexanolone, which was FDA approved maybe about 4 or 5 years ago, which brexanolone was an IV infusion, rather kind of cumbersome to give and to obtain for postpartum depression. But zuranolone recently was given FDA approval as a treatment for postpartum depression. And it's not an SSRI. It works on something called GABA receptors. And, you know, it has a rapidly acting antidepressant effect. And so that is, I think things such as that are really promising because postpartum depression has really been an area that we don't, you know, like many areas of mental health, we don't have treatments that are as rapidly acting and as robust as we would like.
I'm curious, you know, in the recent trial where the PPD drug was approved, I'm curious if you had any thoughts based on your research and experience with these different mental health conditions about why perhaps the major depressive disorder wasn't approved, but postpartum depression was.
So just the backstory for those who are unfamiliar. So zuranolone was simultaneously being investigated for both postpartum depression, but also major depression, you know, so not necessarily related to childbirth. And it did not succeed in the major depression study, whereas it did in the postpartum depression study. So the FDA approved it for postpartum depression, but not for major depression. It's difficult to know, you know, it may be that, that the hormonal changes that are, attendant to postpartum depression were better addressed with, this drug, which is essentially a version of allopregnanolone. And you know, that may have been why it was more robust. I mean, I think I'm just really kind of, engaging in a lot of speculation here, but, you know, unfortunately the data did not support that it worked in major depression. Mm-hmm. You know, that may be an artifact of the way the study was designed. You know, sometimes when you have these sort of disappointing results, you go back to the drawing board and you say, okay, did we do something wrong here? You know, was the dose insufficient? Uh-huh. Was the treatment not long enough? Do we need to look at those kind of things? You know, do we need to, you start looking at various populations in your study and see if one group did better than another, you know, so sometimes you see a sex difference in the data. And so those would, I think, all be the things that you go back and look at after study is unsuccessful.
So are there any known contraindications for psychedelic use that people should be aware of? So we know we talked about bipolar II, it's being studied, or for bipolar generally. But what about any other known contraindications, which is, hey, you know, I heard this, I'm fascinated, I'm going to one of these retreats, you know, or I have a place where I know to use it safely, and I know XYZ about myself, therefore I definitely should not be using it. Like who would that be?
Yeah. Well, you know, I don't want to give medical advice to people that I don't know, but I can tell you some of the things that we exclude in our studies. Definitely people that have a personal history of any psychotic illness. So somebody who's had a history of schizophrenia or bipolar I, particularly with psychosis, or has a first degree relative with a mom, dad, brother, or sister with psychosis in any form, we would be very cautious about and often exclude. So, you know, that's because there is a genetic component to many of these conditions, and sometimes people can have some of the genes which are associated for risk for that condition, and so we'd be very careful around that. The other area where we're very cautious around is people with cardiovascular disorders. So things such as psilocybin and MDMA do cause transient increases in blood pressure and heart rate when the drugs are in effect. And so we're very careful with people that have uncontrolled high blood pressure, or have congestive heart failure, have arrhythmias, cardiac arrhythmias, have heart valve problems. Those are other areas. And then the other thing that we control for in these studies is that in many studies, medications are discontinued. And sometimes that's because they directly interfere with the effects of the drug. So for example, we haven't gotten too much into the weeds of the neurobiology here, but classical psychedelics, which is sometimes referred to as LSD, psilocybin, DMT, which is the active ingredient in ayahuasca, those have part of their effects are mitigated by something called the serotonin 2A receptor. And so a drug that blocks the serotonin 2A receptor, so something such as like trazodone or a whole class of medications called atypical antipsychotics. So this includes things like Seroquel, Zyprexa, Risperidone. Those all block the serotonin 2A receptor and would likely mitigate the effects of a psychedelic that works on serotonin 2A. So it would probably dampen the effects of that. There are other drugs that we have that are contraindicated, which means that we take people off them before they ingest the drug for safety reasons. The sort of the most important one probably in that area would be most antidepressants should not be combined with something called ayahuasca. So ayahuasca is a brew that originates from the Amazon, and it contains at least two different plants, one of which contains the drug dimethyltryptamine or DMT, and the other contains something called an MAO inhibitor. And so MAO is an enzyme that breaks down things like serotonin and norepinephrine, dopamine in your body. And the reason why this brew has both the psychoactive plant and the MAO inhibiting plant is to prevent the ayahuasca from being broken down in the DMT and the ayahuasca from being broken down in the gut before it has a chance to get to the brain. But that creates a potential risk for something called serotonin syndrome if they're taken with an antidepressant that works on serotonin, like a Prozac, Lexapro, Zoloft, something like that. And so generally people need to be off of those medications for some time, and it varies from medication to medication depending on how long the med stays in your body generally for some period of time before they were to ingest ayahuasca. That's a really important safety precaution.
Wow. So what is serotonin syndrome?
Serotonin syndrome is essentially when you have too much serotonergic activity, serotonin activity in your central nervous system. And so people, it can manifest in the form of like jaw clenching, teeth grinding, shivering, difficulty monitoring your body temperature, which is the big risky thing here, is that people can get hyperthermic, something called malignant hyperthermia, where people's body temperature gets very hot, and they have difficulty cooling it down. Serotonin syndrome can result in seizures. It can actually be life-threatening. So it's something that you have to be careful with, particularly with these drugs that work on serotonin. And, you know, you can see serotonin syndrome-like symptoms in people that use excessive amounts of MDMA in one setting. That's a known risk with MDMA. It can also disrupt things such as your sodium levels in your blood, which can lead to swelling in the brain. These are uncommon side effects, to be clear. But it's also one of the reasons why, you know, back in the old rave days, you know, there were issues with hyperthermia because people were often dancing in hot settings. You know, we don't see that happening in our clinical trials because we're monitoring people's temperature. So that doesn't seem to happen when people are not ingesting this in a hot environment and then exercising in the form of dancing. But one of the things that was sometimes happened back then is people would drink excessive amounts of water, which can lead to something called hyponatremia, which is where you sort of flush out a lot of the sodium in your bloodstream. And that causes all sorts of disruptions, including swelling in the brain. So, you know, while people want to, you certainly want to remain hydrated under something like MDMA, you shouldn't be drinking, you know, gallons and gallons of water. That's not a good practice.
I would love to summarize like what people who are curious should do if they're truly interested. And then I want to conclude with like what you're excited about in the near future. We've had a cautionary tale in this discussion. You know, it hasn't been psychedelics are the best thing around. Everyone should be on them all the time. Forget pharmaceutical medications. And I really appreciate that because I do think with the way media, clickbait, you know, all these things, people, I think, take things to a certain level. And look, I'm one who will try anything, but even I'm listening, I've interviewed 3 experts now and I'm like, wow, I'm kind of sold on being really careful.
I think there's sort of a both and answer to that question, right? So, you know, I'm obviously very interested in psychedelics. I spend a lot of my waking hours thinking about it and talking about it and writing about it. So I wouldn't do that if I didn't think there was promise. That said, I want this to succeed. And I want to follow the data, and you know, the thing about science is that, you know, you have to follow the data no matter where it takes you, even if it's not where you thought it was going to take you, or if you're disappointed by it. So, you know, in sort of descending order of probably safety and containment, the more difficult way to have one of these experiences, but probably the safest way to have one of these experiences, is to enroll in a clinical trial. Because it's important to remember that with the exception of ketamine, which is we haven't really talked about, but certainly can have very psychedelic-like effects and is also a rapidly acting antidepressant drug, that the compounds we're talking about today, MDMA, psilocybin, LSD, these are all Schedule I drugs. So they are, as of right now, federally illegal to possess or use. And so the only place where that can be done legally is in a clinical trial. The best way to find clinical trials for anything is something called clinicaltrials.gov. This is a government-sponsored website. It's not sponsored by a drug company. It's just National Institutes of Health. And it is a directory of all clinical trials. It's as simple to use as Google. You know, you could type in there depression and psilocybin, and it will show you all the trials that are going on right now that are about to start, or that, you know, you can filter the results by geography, and at least gives you an idea of if there are studies going on that might be of interest to you. So that's probably the safest way to do it. You know, now some states like Oregon are developing these, what they call adult access programs, adult use programs. So supervised use, not necessarily for a clinical indication. In fact, in Oregon, they specifically cannot say that they're going to treat your depression. So you go to one of these experiences and it's kind of like, I guess, you know, like going to a yoga retreat, right? You don't need a doctor's prescription to go to a yoga retreat, and your work there is largely self-directed. And so a place like Oregon has passed a law that allows for adults to have a psilocybin experience in a supervised setting, which they unpoetically call a psilocybin service center. But that is available to adults going to the state of Oregon. Colorado is also in the middle of a bill that will allow some degree of access. And many states and local areas are starting to kind of dip the toes in the water of various forms of either adult access or decriminalization. And then there are other countries where this is available, you know, Jamaica, Mexico, Peru, Holland, where there is some form of legal access. And as I mentioned before, those kind of settings vary considerably. So, you know, I would really strongly suggest somebody do their research before and talk to people who have been to those settings before going into that. And also understand that we can't necessarily say with certainty at this point that we can replicate these clinical findings in these non-clinical trial settings. So if somebody says, well, you know, you can go to Oregon and take psilocybin for your depression and it'll work just as well as what we're doing at UCSF or at Johns Hopkins, we don't have evidence to support that as of right now. We haven't done that study. It's a study that really needs to be done. You know, we have seen from survey data that people that use psychedelics in a what we call naturalistic setting or maybe recreational self-directed settings, you know, often do report, they self-report benefit. And they also report a small portion of harm. So, you know, these are not without some degree of risk, but the vast majority of people report, you know, some benefit from them as well. So, you know, that has always been and probably will forevermore be one route that people experience psychedelics. And, you know, they certainly people are within their rights to do that. It's just a little less predictable perhaps. But if they are going to do that, you know, to really be thoughtful about how, where, and with whom they do that, you know, to have a place set up where you are away from the distractions of the everyday world. You do not want to be looking at your phone notifications while on a high dose of psilocybin. You don't want to be, you don't want to be in a place where you could fall down and get hurt in that state because, you know, you may not be fully attuned to your body. You ideally want somebody there who can be with you and keep an eye on you and reassure you if you get scared. So these are all sort of harm reduction measures that people can think about, you know, if they are going to pursue this sort of thing on their own, to be really thoughtful about how they do it. That while, you know, certainly many people have had delightful experiences at, you know, a concert or Burning Man or something like that, people also have really challenging experiences out there too. You know, anybody who's worked at a place like Zendo or Rock Med at a concert, you know, knows that people have challenging experiences. It can be very just sensorily overwhelming to be in a concert with lots of people, lots of noise, lots of lights, you know, when your brain and your emotions are in a very raw place. And, you know, the thing with psychedelics, there's kind of an old adage that you don't always get the trip you want, but you get the trip you need.
Yep.
Somebody who goes to, you know, some place like Coachella, you know, and decides to, you know, enhance their music experience with a psychedelic may get that experience. They might also end up thinking about when their mom died when they were 10 years old. And that's going to be a very different experience. And, yep. And it's not to say that thinking about when your mom died when you were 10, it can't be, is necessarily harmful, but Coachella might not be the spot where you want to have that experience.
So what are you excited about in the near future? What are you hopeful for and excited about?
I'm really excited to see the end of, well, so MAPS will soon be submitting something called an NDA, a new drug application, to the FDA for the approval of MDMA assisted therapy for PTSD. And assuming that is approved, that's when things are going to get really interesting, right? So, nice. And really complicated, because We don't really have a healthcare system that's set up for this right now. I mean, we barely have a healthcare system that's functioning as it is. So, you know, to add this layer of complexity is going to create some brand new challenges, which I think create exciting opportunities, but also are going to be challenging to navigate. But I'm really excited at the idea that, you know, I'll share with you a story. You know, so when last time I had to take antibiotics, you know, some crud, I don't remember what it was, but you know, I remember like a day and a half later feeling like myself again, you know, and I thought, damn, I wish the meds I prescribed for people for psychiatric conditions worked this well, right? You know, so the idea of actually, I've been working in mental health for 30 years, you know, and I've seen a lot of people who I have great admiration for who are really struggling, you know, and I really would love as a clinician to be able to offer more robust treatments that actually work better and that sustain that benefit over time and that help people develop a different relationship with these parts of themselves that are, you know, that have depression, that have anxiety, that have trauma, that maybe, you know, what we're doing here is not necessarily eliminating those things. It's not this kind of, you know, like we're going to cut that out of you sort of idea, but that you develop a different relationship with that aspect of yourself in a way that reduces the amount of suffering. And I think that's something that's so important. I'm also really excited as a nurse to see how nursing is going to play a central role in this. I mean, I think nurses bring to this work a sort of a natural skill set and a native sensibility for sitting with people, for making room for healing. That's really excited. I co-founded an organization called the Organization for Psychedelic and Entheogenic Nurses, Open Nurses. And I think nurses are going to be a really important part of delivering this care and also scaling it, because, you know, one of the challenges we're going to have is we don't have enough clinicians to deliver this therapy who have been trained in this. And so I have a vision where many nurses learn how to do this work and can sit with people while they go through these experiences, keep them safe and help them heal.
I did read about the nurses program that you've started, and it sounds wonderful. And I agree, Jordana and Jacqueline and I, which will be the first episode in this series, we talked about, okay, so now we have these approvals. Now what? So
yeah,
absolutely. So it's a really interesting time to be in this space, and
it really
hard,
is,
but interesting problems to solve for sure.
The history of psychedelics is, you know, and the history of plant medicines in general, for which some psychedelics derive from, is really one that was largely occupied by women through much of history. And the people who have carried this knowledge forward and endured a lot of persecution for doing so have largely been women. And so, you know, I think it's just worth acknowledging that debt of gratitude that we will all, if we are successful in this, that we will owe to those women who have very bravely carried this forward.
Oh, thank you. Maybe there'll be a documentary on that, because now you see all these documentaries where they're bringing forth like, oh, there's actually all these women behind the scenes that helped with all these grand moments in the world. So thank you for acknowledging that.
Next year, I'm hoping to go to Saskatchewan, Canada, because there is a nurse there named Kay Parley, who worked with a psychiatrist back in the late 1950s, early 1960s, a guy named Humphrey Osmond. Humphrey Osmond did many things, but one of the things that he also did was coin the term psychedelic, along with his friend Aldous Huxley. And so Kay Parley worked in a large state psychiatric hospital there in Saskatchewan, Canada, using LSD with patients who had alcohol use disorder in the early 1950s and beginning of the 1960s, well before this ever became known to the youth movement and Timothy Leary and all the stuff that happened later. There's a period of history starting with the synthesis of LSD in 1938, going up until 1970 when the Controlled Substance Act was written, of research similar to what we're doing now. Perhaps not as rigorous as the research we're doing now, but there was a lot of interest and a lot of what you might, you know, call sort of above ground scientific work looking at this. And so Kay Parley, she is now 100 years old. Every time we correspond, she reminds me that she says, well, I am a limited time offer. But I've spoken to her on Zoom, and she's sharp as a tack and has some amazing stories to tell about this. So yeah, we want to contribute to the history of this, that focusing some of these women that my friend and colleague Maria Mangini highlighted in a really fantastic paper called Unseen Women in Psychedelic History, which I can't recommend highly enough. Yeah, and she talks about Kay Parley and a number of other women who have been really instrumental in holding this, but don't always get the recognition that they deserve.
And wasn't LSD even discovered in a lab with the scientists from Sandoz, was actually trying to discover something for postpartum?
Well, not for postpartum. Yeah, so the interesting thing, if you indulge me in this for a second, is that so LSD was derived from ergotamine, which is a fungus that grows on rye and other grains. And interesting thing is that midwives have known about ergotamine for centuries, because ergotamine was used as a uterine tonic. So it causes the uterus to contract. And so it was used by midwives in quickening of labor, you know, so for people that were struggling to labor, and also in postpartum hemorrhage to get the uterus to clamp down and cut off the bleeding from where the placenta detaches. And they were, Sandoz was looking at this as a possibility, ergotamines as a possibility, as for something they called an analeptic. And analeptic was a drug it was a respiratory and cardiac stimulant that you would give to people maybe as they were coming out of anesthesia, which, if you remember, you know, it was a fairly new invention. Thank God for anesthesia, but you know, we didn't really have anesthesia until the turn of the 1800s into the 1900s. And also to reverse barbiturate overdoses. So barbiturates, which were the previous drug before benzodiazepines, were much more dangerous in overdose. It's probably a barbiturate overdose that caused Marilyn Monroe's death, for example. And so this idea of developing a drug that would keep people breathing and their heart beating if they were in an overdose situation was the other thing that they were interested in developing. They had no idea it had these psychoactive effects that it does. And as the story goes, that Albert Hofmann, who was the chemist working on this, accidentally ingested some tiny amount, you know, on his fingertips, you know, probably touched his mouth, and thought he'd poisoned himself, actually. And it was actually his young lab assistant, Susie Ramstein, who got him home on a bicycle. That's where the expression bicycle day comes from. It's an acknowledgement of the day that LSD was discovered to have psychoactive effects.
No way.
She got him home.
I haven't heard that yet.
It was 1943. So it was the middle of the war and in Basel, Switzerland, and they didn't have gasoline was rationed. So they were on bicycles. So they got home on their bicycles. He asked that she call his doctor, who examined him and found there's nothing physiologically wrong with him other than his pupils were very dilated. But, you know, he went on to have this rather fantastical experience that, you know, I think he was frankly partially quite scared of. You know, he didn't quite know what he stumbled into. After that, you know, Sandoz sort of had a solution looking for a problem, you know, and they started to try it through sort of crowdsourcing, if you will, to ask psychiatrists to if they wanted to work with it and to report back what they discovered. And so that's how we got LSD, which is really a wild accidental discovery, like a lot of things in science, you know.
Thank you so much for making time and for your dedication and for, you know, giving us the truth about this, because we want people to be safe. And look, I'm all for trying new things, but we want to make sure that we tread with caution when necessary. So thank you so much for sharing the facts and your perspective.
Thanks for having me, Georgie. I appreciate it and enjoyed our talk.
All right. Take care. And that wraps up another empowering session here at the FemPower Health Podcast. Now, before you dash off, I've got a quick, exciting invitation for you. Please join our vibrant community by subscribing to our weekly newsletter, because it's really your frontline update on groundbreaking women's health research, the latest health-enhancing products, fun quizzes to boost your health IQ, and unique discoveries that you won't want to miss. All of this delivered straight to your inbox, cutting through the noise of social media algorithms. Love today's insights? Show your support by rating and reviewing our podcast. Your feedback is more than just a pat on our backs here at FemPower Health. It lights the way for others seeking guidance and community in their health journey, amplifying the voices that need to be heard. And for a deeper dive into today's topics, check out the show notes and explore our website at fempower-health.com. Our site is a treasure trove of knowledge, neatly categorized by topics of interest and life stages, ensuring you find exactly what you need to empower your health journey. And your voice matters to us deeply. Whether you have a question, a story to share, or feedback on our episodes, reach out directly at info@fempower-health.com, drop us a message on social media, or hit reply on any newsletter. Your insights inspire our conversations. And a quick note, the knowledge we share is here to embolden you in discussions with your healthcare provider. It's not medical advice. Always consult with your doctor for health decisions. And remember, the diverse perspectives of our guests reflect their individual journeys, and it's not an endorsement by FemPower Health. Here's to empowering your health journey one episode at a time, and I'll see you on the next FemPower Health podcast episode.